So, I'm looking at the schedule. This is my first time in Site Santa Cruz. So I don't know if Leslie is going to do more announcements now or if I get started. Because
it's all yours, dear.
It's all mine. Okay, great.
You need me down here, but go for it.
So it's really a delight to be here with all of you. And I teach this course up at Stanford on compassion cultivation. And I thought we could talk about that a little bit tonight if you wanted to. And we could also, I could also give more of a Dhamma talk, a little bit of a Dhamma talk, and infuse it with some of that. So I'm trying to decide what you might enjoy. This could be an opportunity to have a... Thank you so much. My allergies are going crazy. To have a little bit of a Q&A. I can say a few things just to get it started, and then we could have a discussion about this topic, because it's quite a beautiful topic. And or I can do the more classic Dhamma talk. A little bit about me that Leslie might not have actually known, but my background is that I'm a former monk. I lived in Burma for some time and practiced quite intensely while I was in Asia. I've been practicing for years now. And so I really love this meditation business. And the course that we teach up at Stanford is a course that is rooted in contemplative practices. And it's a parallel track program where we teach a protocol on cultivating these qualities of compassion. And then that's one track. That's a track that I'm one of the instructors for. And then the parallel track is with the neuroscientists who are doing functional MRI studies to see what happens to the brain when we do these kinds of practices. And they've been doing this for a number of years with mindfulness. So with the program that Jon Kabat-Zinn started and Bob Stahl, who's one of the main teachers in the whole world, actually. You're so lucky to have him here in Santa Cruz. but they've been doing studies on mindfulness for 30 years, 35 years or something now. And it's all over the world. You can hardly go any place where they don't know what MBSR is. And so this compassion program started at Stanford probably about 5 years ago. And it grew out of an encounter at the Mind Life Institute meeting over in India, where the top neuroscientists in the world will go on an annual basis, and mainly to Dharamsala, but they hold meetings sometimes in Europe and sometimes in America. And the Dalai Lama issued a challenge to the scientists at one point, and he said, you know, you come every year and you present all this incredible research that you're doing, but it seems like you dedicate all of your resources to studying pathology. What would happen if you actually took some of those resources and looked at what goes on if you do things that, if you took up practices that were pro-social or that were positive, to put it in sort of lay language. And the scientists sort of took up the challenge. And so part of the studies that have been done on mindfulness really grew out of that. And the studies that are being done now are being done specifically on compassion. And we have to, for those of us in the compassion world, we have to thank all of the work that the people doing MBSR have done for the last 30 years, because where they have gotten in 30 years has taken us about 5 years, but that's because they did all the work and we just came in on the coattails of it. But mindfulness is something that you have to develop. You have to work at it and you have to cultivate this as a practice. Compassion, by contrast, is a natural, innate response. And one of my monastic teachers gave a beautiful description of how a beautiful description of compassion, but also of the other Brahma Viharas. And if you're not familiar with the Brahma Viharas, there's four, and in the Tibetan tradition, they're known as the four immeasurables. So there's this quality of loving kindness, which is called metta. There's this quality of compassion, which is called karuna. A quality of sympathetic or empathetic appreciation or joy, which is called mudita. And then the quality of equanimity. These are four immeasurables. And so the teacher said, all of these qualities emerge out of love. And but they all express in different ways. So for loving kindness, it's when you hold the genuine wish for someone to be happy, to be well, the genuine wish for goodwill and genuine friendliness. I just want you to be happy. I want you to be safe. I want you to thrive. I want you. And it has nothing at all to do with whether you do something that I want you to do. There's no conditions attached to it. With compassion, this is a quality where when love, and I love this description, when love meets suffering, the heart's natural response is compassion. And the reason that I like this definition, or this way of describing it, is that people think that compassion is a quality that we can sort of make ourselves do, that we can make ourselves be compassionate. And that is not, that's not the case. When we're trying to make ourselves be compassionate, we're having something happen, but it's not generally compassion. So I have people say to me all the time, oh, I should have been more compassionate. I should have done this. If only I was more compassionate or something. And there's really no way that you can make yourself be compassionate. You can create the conditions in which compassion can arise. But when this quality, this unconditional quality of goodwill and love encounters suffering in another person or in yourself, then it will naturally express as compassion. And I'll say a little bit more about this later. I just want to go through these four things because I love, this is a very easy way to get a sense of what these different Brahma Viharas are. The third one is sympathetic joy or empathetic joy. And that's the feeling of, like, if something wonderful happens to you, I genuinely am delighted for your good fortune. I don't have a thought bubble that says, oh, good for you, and why didn't it happen to me? You see? So there's no separation between me and the other when this quality is coming forth. This doesn't get as much airtime, but in fact it's a beautiful quality. This quality to be genuinely happy for someone else. You see? So if you think about it, if you saw like a child learn how to swim or something, and they just are so happy that they can now go into the swimming pool, and you just are happy for them. You see, it has nothing. It's just all about them and your happiness for them. So this can express in many different ways. But the beautiful thing is that this is a quality that's infused with connection. If there's any sense of separation, this quality cannot actually manifest. And it's the very same thing with compassion. If there's any sense of separation, then you fall out of the zone of compassion. And it's one of the ways that you can tell when you're actually being compassionate. So I will talk a little bit more about that. And then the fourth quality is that of equanimity. And so his simple little pithy description of it is when love meets acceptance, the result is equanimity. So when we can be with whatever the situation is without resistance is what that means. It doesn't mean that everything is suddenly okay and calm. It means that we're okay. And, you know, we're in the middle of the hurricane that's swirling around us, but we're okay. We're still, everything is fine in that way. And that's what equanimity is. It's this beautiful quality. So it's this quality of acceptance. So does anybody want to share let me just ask you to popcorn out, rather than having anybody feel like they're on the spot, what you think some qualities of compassion might be. Now, I'm going to prime the pump a little bit because we just went through that meditation. So some qualities could be this feeling of spaciousness, this feeling of openness, this feeling of acceptance. It could be a feeling of letting go. It could be a feeling of tenderness. Any other ideas?
Generosity.
Thank you.
Not thinking about yourself when you're doing and
About yourself. Okay.
Groundedness.
Groundedness. Light. Thank you.
Attunement.
Attunement.
Having some knowledge of suffering. Having some knowledge of suffering or experiencing?
Having some knowledge of suffering. Great. Yes.
Wanting to touch someone.
Wanting to touch someone, to reach out and touch someone. We call that connection. Yeah.
Resonance. I was going to say resonance.
Resonance. Great. One more? One or two more?
Your description made me think of like you have to create a vacuum, get your own stuff out of the way, and then that will be your natural being able to just come forth.
It'll just come forth. Yeah. So all of those are spot on descriptions of compassion. But, you know, someone's idea of resonance, someone said resonance, might not be someone else's idea of resonance, and someone's idea of fill in the blank might not be somebody else's idea. Although, when we say these qualities, we all recognize them as compassion, right? Did anyone not recognize what anyone said as being compassionate? Right. So, in order to actually talk about compassion in a way that everybody knows that you're on the same page, you have to have a definition for it. And for those of people in this room who've taken my course already, they know the definition. I should ask my students what the definition of it is.
see you look right over here. Huh?
All right, I won't put you on the spot, but your comment is the very first aspect of compassion. It's a cognitive awareness that suffering is happening, either for another person or for yourself. So you have this awareness that suffering is going on. And then the second aspect is emotional. It's an affective response to the awareness of suffering. So it's got this emotional quality to it. We know that suffering is happening and we feel something, right? The third is maybe the most important in terms of distinguishing compassion from empathy. And that is that it's the wish. It always has the wish to alleviate or mitigate the suffering. So compassion will always have this component. And then the fourth is the motive. It's a movement towards altruism. It's the motivation to action if there is some action to be taken. Now, in some cases, there's nothing that you can do. You see? In some cases, to try to fix something is completely useless, and it's decidedly not a compassionate action. It's an imposition. You see? It's a way of trying to be comfortable with something that is difficult, and you can't be. And so you just busy yourself and try to fix it. So, to try to cure someone or fix someone is, in some cases, much different than caring for someone. You see, that curing, that fixing quality can actually feel like an assault to some people. You see, first of all, if it can't be fixed, but secondly, it's, and this is something that's so important, is that we fall out of touch with other people when we're imposing our need to be comfortable. So when I do grief work, when I went through my grief bereavement training, they did this beautiful, simple, they gave us this beautiful, simple instruction, which is so obvious that most people don't think about it until it's actually pointed out. We're told, you know, we're going to be with people who are really in deep distress, and so we're going to be with people who are crying and people who are angry and just really heightened emotions. And he said, so when a person starts to cry and you pick up the Kleenex and give the Kleenex box to the person, it seems like it's a generous thing to do, but in fact, sometimes that interrupts a person's process and it sends a message to them in some unspoken way that you're uncomfortable with them being authentically where they are. And so they start to close down around it. So you see this oftentimes when a person is surrounded, the person is terminal and dying, and they're surrounded by their family, and their family is fight, 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 we're going to beat this, we're going to beat this. And then the dying person is exhausting themselves trying to protect their family from the fact, from the reality of this situation. I just witnessed this last weekend. I was called to a hospital where the mom was on a ventilator, and she can't, you know, she needs to be on a ventilator in order to stay alive. And she needs her family to say they love her, and that, you know, that they're there. That's what she needs. And they keep saying, you know, breathe. Don't forget to breathe. And it's all about a medical thing. And I'm saying that like it's, it, you know, like I'm making light of it. I'm not. My heart was breaking when I saw this, because when we fall out of presence with someone else because we become so distressed ourselves, we inadvertently fall out of presence with ourselves, and then we're no good to anyone. So when this happens, it's oftentimes referred to as compassion fatigue, but in fact, have you all heard this term, compassion fatigue? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there is no such thing as compassion fatigue. Now, some of my colleagues will disagree with me, but behind closed doors, they will say, well, we know there's no such thing as compassion fatigue, but it's so much part of the vernacular that rather than to, you know, counter it, we just call it compassion fatigue. What is actually happening is empathic fatigue, empathy fatigue, empathic distress, it's called. And the difference between empathy and compassion is that with empathy, it's the willingness, it's the ability to resonate with what someone else might be feeling and the willingness to feel it. It doesn't mean that you can actually feel what someone else, now some people can almost do that, but it's that you can imagine what someone else is feeling and you have a willingness to feel it. So you can understand that in a situation like that, there's only so much empathy that you can have before, boom, you go right over the edge. It's like there's an empathy tank, but there's no such thing as a compassion tank. Compassion emerges out of love. And the truth of the matter is, just check your own experience. The more you love, the more generosity you have, the more generosity there is. The more love you have, the more love there is. The more compassion you have, the more compassion there is. You can't run out of compassion, but you can run out of empathy. Empathy can overwhelm you. You can feel so strongly for someone else, or get so involved in what's going on for someone else that it can literally knock you sort of off your perch, so to speak. So I want to give you an example from my own personal life, which my students have heard, but I'm going to share it anyway. You can hear it again. So I was a new hospice worker, and I was working at a residential hospice in San Francisco, the Zen Hospice Project. And there was a woman in the hospice that was, she had no family and very few friends. She was a lovely woman, but that was just her situation. And she was dying from esophageal cancer. And she went into an active dying process. She was dying. And so they asked the volunteers if we would sit vigil with her because she had no one. And so in my enthusiasm for doing this work, I very naively volunteered to be one of the people doing that. And I got the shift from 2 in the morning until 7 in the morning or something like that. It was right in the middle of the night when everything seems more intense if you're struggling. And when I arrived there, her name was Muriel, and when I arrived, Muriel could not lie down anymore because she was suffocating. She couldn't breathe. And so the other volunteer was sitting on the edge of the bed holding her up. And she was really agitated and almost panicked because she would try to breathe and then she couldn't breathe and then she'd get her breath and she was, and this was sort of the state at which I arrived, and I was a totally green volunteer. I was almost a brand new volunteer, but they didn't have many choices, so they took me. So I moved in, and I'm sitting on the bed, and I'm holding Muriel up, and she was quite small at this point, so it wasn't difficult to hold her up. But what was difficult was that she was so upset. She was so frightened. She was so panicked. And she would try to breathe, and she couldn't breathe, and then she would just go completely, and she would fall into a panic. And I kept saying to her, Muriel, watch me breathe. Just watch me breathe. Try to breathe with me. And then I would breathe slowly. And so she tried it. And she could get her breath for a few breaths, and then she would lose it again. And so this went on for two or three times. Muriel, watch me breathe. Watch me breathe. And then she lost it again. And I repeated the same thing. You know, it's like a broken... What is that? The definition of stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. So I said, watch me breathe. Watch me breathe, Muriel. Just try to watch me breathe. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. At which point this woman opened her eyes with this look. Is this the dumbest man on the planet? And she said, God damn it, Robert, it is not going to be okay. I am dying for Christ's sake. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, she gave me a precious gift to know all she needed me to do was to sit there and hold her and let her know that she was cared for and wasn't alone. That's all she needed. That's all that I could do. I couldn't make her suffocation go away. I couldn't make her death go away. She didn't expect me to do that. And when I tried to fix that situation, it had more to do with my level of discomfort than her actual situation. I mean, I was responding to it. I don't want to be terribly harsh on myself, but the fact is that I lost connection with her, and in the process, I lost connection with myself. And she actually brought me back. And so we just sat there. I just held her all night long. And then she died in the morning. But this is the difference between empathy and compassion. Because holding her in silence and letting her feel my care and connection was an expression of compassion. Trying to fix this unfixable situation was an example of what is called empathic distress. So what many people do, whether you're in a life-death situation or whether you're in, some more normal exchange with families or friends or colleagues or whatever, when we fall out of connection with what's going on within us, we are also out of connection with what's going on with the other person. And therein lies the role of mindfulness in the service of cultivating compassion. Because without mindfulness, you don't even know that you're not present any longer. You see? When you are mindful of what's happening in your experience, you know the difference between when you're present with someone And when you're distracted, when you're lost in thought, or when you're lost in emotions, or whether you're, when you're lost in some sort of a deep underlying tendency, a mindset, so to speak. And when that gets out of sync, it's very easy to identify that when you bring mindfulness to the process. So they've done studies, and I was actually going to do my whole talk on this study, but I'm just going to wrap this in. They have done studies where they've looked at how people engage or disengage with one another. They've done this specifically with healthcare workers, but how one engages or disengages. And rather than to get lost in that, to begin to use that as a barometer to tell where you are in the continuum of connection with one another. So there's this quality of when you're faced with a helpless situation like the one I just described with Muriel, what happened to me was I went into this mode of hyper-engagement. And hyper-engagement has an anxious, pressured, a desperate quality to it. And it's related to a sense of, just as I said, empathic over-arousal. I was agitated by this state. And a lot of people will find themselves doing this as a default mode. They're fixers. As soon as something happens, they go into a fixing mode. Do you recognize this at all? Do you recognize it? No? Right. So this kind of hyper-engagement has certain qualities to it, and some of them I just described to you. The other, the opposite, is called, it's a hypo, it's an under-engagement. And it feels resigned and passive and apathetic. And this is the state that is related to empathic distress. And it causes sort of burnout, vicarious traumatization, and so on and so forth. And it doesn't make any difference whether you go into a hyper-engagement or a hypo-engagement. Both of them will disconnect you from what's actually happening in relationship with one another. But more importantly, or equally important, is that it disconnects us from ourselves so that we don't know that we're actually experiencing this. So the way that I understand it in my own direct experience is that when I'm upset about something, you see, there's this quality of suffering from being upset. You know, I'm agitated and I'm feeling the effects of the agitation, but I don't really name or know that I'm agitated. I'm just suffering from agitation. But the moment I know that I'm agitated, the relationship with the suffering changes. It's not like the suffering magically goes away, but the relationship to it changes. And in that changing relationship, there is a kind of spaciousness that allows me to come back into presence. Because when I'm just suffering, I'm overwhelmed. But when I know that I'm overwhelmed, I'm already coming back into presence. You see? It's like if you get angry with somebody, right? And you just spin out into some argument or some irritable lashing out or something, you're just lost in it. But the moment that you know, oh my God, anger is here. You see, once you can identify anger, then there's the possibility that you can see that anger has consequences, and this is where anger will lead, and, you know, if I do this, it's going to harm someone else, it's going to harm myself, I'm going to regret what I've said, it's not that anger is an unnatural emotion. It's a very natural emotion, and sometimes it's a very appropriate emotion. But when we get lost in these things, we lose presence, and this is where mindfulness comes in. So in order to cultivate a quality like compassion, we have to be able to be with that place inside of ourselves that's difficult, that's feels raw, you see? Or we have to have the courage to sit with Muriel while she's dying and not abandon her because we are upset that this is scaring us. So a lot of people think compassion is this soft California touchy-feely kind of thing. Compassion is absolutely powerful, and it requires tremendous strength and courage. Sometimes it feels very, it feels that nice sort of way, but sometimes it really requires that you be very clear about your boundaries, and it doesn't mean that you allow people to behave poorly or that you allow yourself to behave poorly. It means that even if someone is behaving poorly, you still see the humanity in them underneath their behavior. Does this make sense? Is this making sense? So why would you want to be compassionate? You're going to turn it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Why would you want to be compassionate? Or let me put it this, let me ask it this way. Not why would you want to be compassionate, why might you not want to be compassionate? What would prevent you from being compassionate?
Yeah, I have a question about that exactly. I know that people who are drawn to therapeutic positions, caretaking, and therapists of all sorts, often they come from families where their parents were mentally ill or alcoholic or severely dysfunctional in some way. And for me, working as a therapist for many years or caretaker, I started not to trust my own motivation for caring because of that sort of, it went even deeper than fixing, but it was sort of a mindset of, okay, this is my role, and it seemed like a one that society would sanction, and it seemed like a good thing to do, but then I started questioning more and thinking, well, why do I need to do this?
To
take care of other people, to work in a profession that requires a lot of empathy. And I just felt like, is this a kind of deep mindset that I need to uproot? I became suspicious of my own motivation.
Of your motivation to be a therapist?
Yeah, or even in more casual relationships, to be compassionate or to be there. It seemed like kind of like I couldn't be sure of what my motivation or how healthy it was.
So I'm going to be completely honest with you because I'm not really understanding what the quandary is. Are you questioning your wish to be compassionate with other people,
the urge to be compassionate is to alleviate suffering. But I felt like, well, why is that always my urge? Maybe I need to learn how not to be that way. Otherwise, it's a compulsion. Otherwise, it's not freedom.
So, is there a sense of obligation to be compassionate?
I felt like it was more a sense of this is my identity. I've built my identity in this kind of a personality. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's not so healthy in the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. So, well, that's maybe something worth investigating. But in terms of of whether compassion should be withheld. I would ask you, if you withhold compassion, what does it feel like? If you withhold compassion, if you were to withhold compassion, what do you think it would feel like?
Well, it feels when I do that, it feels like I'm holding on. I'm trying very hard to keep my boundaries. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to feel compulsive about it, about being compassionate.
Okay, so rather than focusing on compassion, I would say, just as a suggestion, you can try this, is to bring mindfulness to this quandary of compulsion and make that an inquiry. Make that inquiry the object of the meditation rather than whether compassion is, you should or you shouldn't be compassionate. Because my response was that in every situation, compassion will always bring freedom and liberation. And that's part of the reason that definition works so beautifully well across the board. But if one feels like they're forcing something or they need to do something in order to feel happy, the condition for the happiness is an obscuration to compassion. So what you're describing would be called a fear of compassion. And that's actually what I'm asking people for. Other fears of compassion are, at Stanford, you can imagine it's not a mellow place. It's a highly competitive place. And so people are afraid that if they're self-compassionate, that their house of cards is going to fall in on them, and people are going to get ahead of them, and they're going to be exposed as frauds, and so on and so forth. People are afraid to be compassionate because they think that if I'm kind to someone and compassionate to someone and they're needy, they're going to suck me dry. Or they're going to latch on to me, and this is going to, this is another. People are afraid to be compassionate because they think that they need to sort of be harsh with themselves and critical of themselves in order to motivate themselves. When in fact, studies have shown that that's the exact opposite: being self-compassionate and self-kindness is actually what is beneficial for people. So these are some of the reasons why people, these are some of the things that steer people from being compassionate. Here's another one. This one is the one that I'm guilty of. It's all right for you not to be perfect, but God forbid that I shouldn't be perfect. I have to be perfect. We can cut ourselves any slack. We can accept that other people are human beings and can do, be less than perfect, but we always have to be perfect. Does anybody relate to that? Please.
I was just also going to throw in a teaching I heard one time, and some of you may have been around for, with Jill Shepherd, that was so helpful, where she talked about all of the Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurables, kind of as a package, and that we start by softening the heart with loving kindness. And then when the heart's kind of softened, then we're better able to let in the pain and the joy. But it doesn't work without the balancing and kind of crowning quality of equanimity, which helps to hold the pain and joy. And so for me, I've sometimes needed to recognize I had to step back
and really cultivate some equanimity as a way to hold in balance and find where that balancing point is, when it might really be more self-compassionate for me to do something at a certain point in time that nourished that steadiness and equanimity more directly.
So
equanimity can be a vague sounding word, but I've come to really get more kind of a felt sense, a body sense of when I'm feeling equanimity and what helps me to cultivate that. And that's made it easier to find that balance for me. I can just sort of speak from personal experience.
Mm-hmm. These qualities sort of wrap into one another.
Yes.
It's not like they're separate and isolated. They all sort of flow into one another. Especially loving kindness and compassion, it's the flip side of the same coin. It's just a different expression in a way. So for some people, you know, when you teach or when you're taught loving kindness practice, like I was one of these people, I just did not get metta practice for years. I did not get it. I couldn't feel anything. I was given these phrases to say, may I be happy, may you be. And it was just like rote nonsense to me. It was like gibberish. And at a certain point, I realized, oh, well, this becomes like the breath. It's the object of the meditation. You keep the focus on the phrases, and then you become concentrated. And that's a very legitimate form of what they call samatha meditation, concentration meditation. But that is not loving kindness practice. That's concentration practice. So some people will report just what I shared with you, that it's difficult for them to understand what the feeling of loving kindness is. So this protocol that we teach at Stanford is there's a slight shift in a slight but very deliberate shift in the way that it's taught, because we, rather than using the phrases to evoke the feelings, we evoke the feelings and then we use the phrases to support the actual feeling of loving kindness. So one of the ways that we would do that is that we rather than starting with ourselves, because that's so charged for most of us, we start with someone that's easy to feel affection for. So we say, pick a loved one. And then the instruction is that a loved one, you have to pick the right loved one. So we say, probably don't pick your partner, you know, and don't pick your 14-year-old teenager who's going through a difficult phase. See, so these relationships where we're in negotiations with one another get complicated. Does the toilet paper come over the top or under the bottom? Where do you squeeze the toothpaste from? You see? So, but someone that's very easy to feel affection for. So if a parent had like a 3 or 4 year old adorable kid and a 14 year old who's going through a phase, better to go with the 3 or 4 year old kid than it is to. So it's important to get a loved one, because if you have the right loved one, because it's not so much who you pick, it's whether the feeling can actually be generated. So the instruction is very simple. It's like you pick this loved one, and then you're guided through a series of steps to imagine what it feels like somatically. What does it feel like when you think of this person? Could even be your pet. Could be the dog that meets you at the door, wagging its tail, just so happy to see you. And you feel this, oh, this is wonderful. I love this dog. I love my dog. I love my cat. I love my kid. I love my grandma, I love my, et cetera, et cetera. And so this quality of feeling, this quality, so you get this sense of warmth or tenderness or goodwill, or you think of someone and you just think of, what do you feel like when you bring that person to mind? Then you flip it over and you think of that person in distress, going through some situation that is difficult for them. It's like it's difficult for me since my wife just fell asleep. That's difficult for them. And then you see, what does it feel like? What does it feel like when there's someone that you love in distress? You feel like you want to reach out and help? You feel some sort of tenderness for them? What is it that you feel? So this would be the feeling of compassion. So some people report that they can't really get the loving kindness thing. But when they practice compassion, it comes, and then they understand what loving kindness is. You see? So it can come through different doorways. So one person described that was the very experience that they had. They had picked someone that they thought they thought they should have as a loved one, but they weren't feeling anything. And then they were really upset because they weren't feeling anything. You see? And then they got themselves in a real states because they thought they were terrible people or something. But the moment that meditation shifted and they thought of this person, this loved one, in distress, you see, they picked their teenage daughter. And when they thought of her in distress, then their heart just completely opened with a sense of care and concern and this feeling of compassion, and this is loving kindness, except it's expressing it as compassion. I can't stand it. I'm sorry.
My leg fell asleep and it's giving me hell.
Maybe we all need to stretch.
Yeah, if you want to all stand up, you can all stand up, but you don't have to. But that quality is a quality that can be recognized through mindfulness. And you become sensitive to what these experiences feel like. It's the same feeling of being present with someone, or you're having a conversation, but you're planning your vacation. Or they're saying something and you're not really listening, you're thinking of what you're going to say back to them. Or why they're wrong and you're right. Instead of just giving your full attention to someone and really listening. So, I want to say a little bit about self-compassion, too. Self-compassion is a quality. Are any of you familiar with the work of Kristen Neff? Yeah? Sure. She's wonderful. I might have to sit in a chair. I just need a different cushion. This cushion has got me. My tendon is locked up. Thank you. Yeah, maybe. So much for being a monk for all of us.
We are the nature.
Yeah. I was younger in those days. So Kristen Neff has three qualities that she says are always present with self-compassion. And those three qualities are mindfulness, the recognition of common humanity, and this quality of self-mentoring. So say a little bit about each of those qualities, and then I want to tell you an experience of self-compassion to just show you some different ways in which it can express itself. So mindfulness is literally the ability to recognize the suffering, the cognitive awareness of suffering. But it's that ability to be with that place inside of us that feels raw. It's where we lose ourselves and go down the rabbit hole. You see? And so when we touch that place, most of us just react and we go down the rabbit hole time after time after time. But with mindfulness, you begin to see and recognize what's happening and where you are. You see? So mindfulness stabilizes your ability to be with what's difficult. It doesn't make what's difficult go away. It simply allows you to be there. Common humanity is the recognition that everyone experiences that place of losing themselves. Everyone. Whatever is going on for you that's difficult doesn't separate you from other people. It actually connects you to other people if you see it in the right way. So this quality of common humanity recognizes and accepts that at our core level, no matter what issues we're having that are difficult for us, we all are essentially alike in that we all want to be free from suffering. Is there anyone in the room that doesn't want to be free from suffering? Probably not, right? So another way of saying it is everybody wants to be happy. But I had a woman in my class in the wintertime who raised her hand and said, "That is not true. I do not want to be happy." I said, "Okay. Do you want to suffer?" She said, "No." And I said, "Okay, then think of it that way." So common humanity recognizes that the suffering that you're experiencing isn't unique to you. There are countless numbers of beings throughout the world who are suffering in exactly the same way that you are suffering at any given moment. You see? And there are countless numbers of beings in the world that you are unaware of that are wishing you well by doing these Brahma-Vihara practices, these metta practices and compassion practices, the same way that when you do them for other people, they probably don't know that you're doing them. See? So, in this way, when we see that our perceptions and beliefs about our inadequacies and our foibles and our, you know, that we're frauds and we're this and we're that these things don't separate us. Everybody has these issues going on. So, common humanity. And then the third quality, she refers to as self-mentoring. And that's where you become really sensitive to that inner voice, that inner critic that sits on your shoulder and yammers in your ear endlessly. When you notice that you would never dream of speaking to another person the way that you speak to yourself, that's the voice that we're talking about. And to learn to reframe that voice, to mentor yourself with kindness, is key to self-compassion. So to bring a little science into this, they've done recent neural imaging studies where they looked at people who were anticipating difficult, stressful situations. And when they did the functional MRIs, the part of the brain that went wild, that lit up, was the ancient part of the brain, the limbic brain, the seat of emotions, fight, flight, or freeze, the amygdala and the anterior insular cortex. And they saw, because this study was looking at the inherent neuroplasticity of the brain, and they saw that through a simple reframing of the way that that situation was being held, rather than anticipating that it was going to be a disaster, if you just had a more open mind about it, another part of the brain was activated, which was actually the reward centers of the brain. And what happens is that new neural synapses could be trapped, and that part of the brain began to grow new gray matter. And the limbic brain quieted down, and a shift happens, because every time we default to reacting in a certain way, we reinforce that habit of mind as though we were going to the gym working a muscle. So when we begin to train and create these new neural pathways, we are actually beginning to counter these old habitual habits of behavior, of thoughts, of thinking, and so on and so forth, and create a new default response to the challenges, the ebb and flow of what's, you know, what occurs in our daily life experience. And these studies were important because they indicate that depending on the way that we train ourselves and depending on the way that we respond, it mitigates the kind of emotional response that we're going to have. So it helps us to, in terms of emotional regulation. I love that science has proven what meditators have been practicing for thousands of years. And I love the fact that science isn't saying they're discovering anything new. All they're doing is validating what people have been doing for years and years and years. So self-compassion can be something as simple as just naming that you're having stress, that a situation is difficult. And Kristen will offer very simple things. And this one is a little bit hard for me, but she'll say, like, oh, just talk to your husband. Say, oh, honey, this is hard. You're okay. And, you know, hug yourself in that. And say, you know, that works for some people. And it's a great thing to do, because it's like taking a breath in the middle of a freak out. It just breaks the momentum. Even if it's only for a moment, it breaks the momentum, and it helps to reestablish you with what your intention is, which is to be compassionate in this case. And that helps bring us back into presence. And we might fall out 10,000 more times. It doesn't make any difference at all, as long as we learn these simple techniques for coming back. So sometimes self-compassion can feel as simple as what I just described. And sometimes it's just naming that you're hurting, that suffering is happening. And then there's another way, but I want to respond.
Well, it made me think about the idea of faking it till you make it.
Yep.
Did you say that that's the same thing? Are you talking about that?
Yes, I absolutely would say fake it until you make it. And the reason is that these meditation practices work when you think that they're not working. They absolutely do. But you have to do them. You see? When people come to the course, one of the things that I've tried to be really clear about is that you can come to the course, you can take the course, you can read all the books, you can read all the articles and the scientific studies that I put on the website and all of the other readings and so on and so forth, and you'll get an academic understanding of what compassion is. But in order to actually have the experience of what it's like to live a compassionate life, you have to do the practices. You have to do the meditation. You have to develop it. Because it's about learning to discipline the mind. The mind does not want to be with that which is uncomfortable. It just doesn't want or are unpleasant. And that's what compassion is all about. It's with being with that quality that causes us to be stressed out. So when love meets that quality, the heart's natural response is compassion. So sometimes compassion, self-compassion, can show up rather than that feeling of warmth or tenderness or caring or something. Those sort of more, I don't want to say ordinary, but more expected kinds of ways that it will show up. Sometimes it shows up differently. And I'll share an experience from my personal life, which is very personal, but it's apropos to what I'm talking about, and it can be a real eye-opener for it. It was an eye-opener for me, and I hope it will be for you. And if it's too personal, I apologize in advance, but I'm not on a limb, so I'm going to go for it. So I had an experience where, first of all, I should say, as a long-time meditator and as a hospice worker and as a grief counselor, I thought I knew a little bit about compassion. And I did. I did know a little bit about compassion, but I didn't know that I had never experienced self-compassion. That I didn't know. And I had an experience when I went through my training where something triggered me. I had an event happen that was very triggering to me. It was so insignificant that it really confused me because there was nothing significant about the trigger other than the fact that it triggered me. And I literally went over the deep and was drowning in a full-blown panic attack that went on almost for a day, just unrelenting, and I could hardly breathe. And this experience was so intense, and I know that whether you're a man or a woman, nobody wants to feel out of control and vulnerable, but it felt so, as a male, I felt so ashamed. I felt so emasculated and demeaned in some way. And just, it was like everything that I could think about that would be the worst thing in the world that I want to feel, I felt it like 100 times over. And it just was, it would come like tsunami in waves and waves. It just kept overwhelming me. And as I said, I've been meditating for a long time, so I have more than a few tools in my meditation tool bag. And I pulled out every one of them to try to make this feeling go away. Follow this carefully. I wanted this feeling to go away. I wanted to cure it, to fix it. And what happened was that it was like I was throwing gasoline on a fire. It was just fueling it. The more I tried to resist it, the stronger it became. And I thought, you know, I'm going to really lose it. I've got to sit down in my cushion and try, you know, I'm going to meditate this away. God damn it. And I thought, this is useless, because if I sit in my cushion, I'm going to be bouncing off the walls. I've got wild elephants going on in my mind, raging. And I sat down, and sure enough, wild elephants were raging. And I was so distraught. And somehow, in the middle of that, a thought floated across my radar screen that I was reacting to a biochemical feeling, a somatic experience, that I was telling this story about. You see, so this was the first moment that I had enough mindfulness that happened by accident to see that I was spinning this story in response to this feeling. Now, the feeling could be akin to like almost getting run over in a crosswalk, and then you survive and you're just like this. That really intense adrenaline, just intense adrenaline that being poisoned in some way. And in that moment, I saw suffering. In that moment, I was feeling suffering, but I hadn't recognized it. See? So I actually saw suffering. And in the moment I saw suffering, I saw it was my suffering, that I was suffering. See? And in the moment that I saw that I was suffering, I disappeared and became the suffering of all people. I saw this as the suffering that everyone experiences. And it's true, everyone does experience this suffering. And in that instant, I had a meditative experience where I felt the crown of my head literally open, and I felt as though the weight of a lifetime or lifetimes passed through my body and come out my hands and feet. And for the first time in my life, I had experienced self-compassion, and I recognized it as self-compassion. And in that moment, I didn't feel warm and fuzzy. I felt liberated. I felt released. And it wasn't that the resonance of that shock suddenly disappeared. It was still there, and it was just as strong as it had ever been. But I saw that it was something that was going to, it just needed to process. It just needed to be released. And so in an instant, my relationship to it changed. I was in the eye of the hurricane, and it could just go, you see. And I didn't do anything. In fact, I wasn't there at all. I just witnessed this thing happen. And this is another way. This was a beautiful experience. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't screw up all the time and forget that I had that experience. But the fact is that having had it, I see what the power of self-compassion is. Because literally it changed the way that I practice. I no longer struggle with my meditations at all. At all, at all, at all. I see everything as an opportunity to be held and met with kindness. Everything. So every time there's a struggle in meditation, it's not that I'm a screw-up, it's that I have an opportunity to practice self-compassion. You see? And every time you meet a difficulty or a challenge in that way, you're living in that moment self-compassion. You're a living example of what self-compassion is. And this is transformative. It changes your life. So it changed the way that I practice, it changed the way I relate to myself, and it changed the way I relate to everyone else. and it has never gone back. Now, as I said, that doesn't mean that I don't curse at my computer screen and get mad when people are cutting me off on the freeway or something like that. But it's all done, it's all held in a different way. There's much more resilience, there's much more flexibility, there's much more, it's a quicker recovery time. And you begin to catch these things and you just become a little bit kinder and nicer in the process. Something like that. It's a beautiful practice. So this practice of self-compassion is so terribly important. And I want to just say that compassion moves in three directions. Seems obvious, but I'm going to name them anyway. So compassion is from self to other, from other to self, and from self to self. So how many people in this room find it easier to give compassion to someone else than it is to give compassion to yourself? Look around. You see? This is absolutely the case here in the West. How many people find it easier to give compassion to someone else than it is to get compassion from someone else? Yeah. So you're a unique group because that's actually the most difficult thing for people to do. And I was surprised to learn that. I thought it would be self-compassion. But here's another assumption that I want to bring up. But how many people think that in order to be compassionate, really compassionate, you have to be self-compassionate first? Yeah. So that's a common assumption that's not accurate, because there are people, and I was one of those people, where you learn what compassion feels like by offering compassion to other people. So by working in hospice and by working with grieving people and so on and so forth, I didn't know what compassion felt like. But I didn't know how to give that compassion to myself. So it wasn't that I learned how to give myself that compassion, but it was that when that self-compassion arose, I recognized it because I had been able to practice compassion for other people. So that's a common assumption. There's another assumption that I want to debunk for you all, since I only have a few minutes left. And that is that people will frequently express this idea that if they're compassionate, whatever trouble they're having, that they're feeling compassionate towards, that that's going to be the resolution and reconciliation of whatever that problem happens to be. And that is sometimes the case, but more often than not, it's not the case. So in the example that I just gave you of my own experience, my initial experience with self-compassion, I was still like this. You see, it was as though I had stepped up the curb and the truck almost ran me over. I jumped back onto the curb. I knew I was safe. The driver knew I was safe. He drove on. I'm standing there. But I was still like this. I'm still like that. And so it was like that. It didn't resolve that, but what it did was to change my relationship to that. So sometimes things just can't be resolved. Muriel was dying, and that's all. She looked at me and said, "It is not okay. I'm dying for Christ's sake." You see? So compassion then expressed as courage, the willingness and the strength to not abandon your seat, to hold your place, to hold her in the kindness of your heart, to feel that connection. You see? And one of the most precious gifts that we can give to one another is to actually be present for someone. To actually see them, to actually hear them, to be so present that we hear not only what they're saying, what their words are, but what they're not, what they're leaving unsaid. There's a beautiful quote by Thich Nhat Hanh where it's like a prayer to Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara, the incarnation of infinite compassion. He says, we aspire to learn your way of listening because just by listening, we heal other people by bringing that quality of presence and care and concern. So I have a lot more that I could say, but we're pretty much out of time. And I just want to ask if there are any questions while we still have a few minutes, or comments, or anything that you would like to talk about, please.
Well, it has
and speak a little bit louder because my.
Sure. It has made me remember a time when a friend of mine was dying in Santa Barbara. He was in hospice, and I was much younger. But I ended up leaving to go do some frivolous thing. I think it was actually swimming or whatever. He was a swimmer, I was a swimmer. And even as I was going, I realized this is not the right action, but I was clueless what the right action was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the years have gone on and I have thought to myself, you could have just sat there and read a magazine and just stayed in the room, you know. We had kind of pushed past our intimacy level, so neither one of us were really very comfortable with the situation. Mm-hmm. And I chose, because I didn't know what else to do, I was so uncomfortable, mm-hmm. to leave. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had just stayed, you know, just stayed put. But really, I wasn't mature enough at the time to figure out that's what was called.
Thank you very much for sharing that. And I want to say that this is an expression of self-compassion. To be honest with yourself about the opposites that exist in that scenario. You wish that you had done something. You didn't. You know now that you weren't able to at that time. And all those things are true simultaneously. And by not abandoning yourself, that's an act of self-compassion. And the reason that it's important to begin to recognize when self-compassion or compassion arises is if you're trying to cultivate a habit, if a moment like that occurs and you don't recognize it as a moment of self-compassion, it's like a random act of kindness. It comes and it goes, and so you can't really build a habit. So, but when you know that that's what it is by cultivating mindfulness, then you can begin to connect the dots. And it's just like if you're meditating and developing a concentration practice, first you find the breath. Let's say you're using the breath as the object. First you find the breath. And then you learn to be with the breath for longer and longer periods of time. You be more continuous with your attention. And as you're continuous with your attention, the mind begins to stabilize and settle down. And so you cultivate, in a way, the habit of learning how you settle down. So to cultivate compassion, it's no different. To cultivate compassion, you recognize what is compassion. And part of it is like recognizing what the fear of compassion is, what obscures it. But you recognize when compassion shows up, and then this is a moment of compassion, this is a moment of compassion, this is a moment. And then you become very familiar with what it feels like when you're in this moment of compassion. And at the same time, because you're cultivating, because you're using mindfulness in order to do this, you become very familiar with what it's like when you're not in some, when you've lost presence with yourself. Does that make sense? And it's just like Leslie was saying, you know, equanimity. Sometimes you need equanimity. Sometimes you need to soften your heart in order to let the suffering in. That softening of the heart is an expression of compassion.
I just also wanted to add from my personal experience, again, and I've heard it from others, we can tend to speak about compassion and self-compassion as if they're difficult things that take a lot of work. And in some ways they are, and yet there's also paradoxically this just this natural flow that actually can be a tremendous source of well-being. Some of you know I work with people at Dominican Oaks, and I teach a course based on James Barrows' Awakening Joy. And one of the pieces in the course that I see awaken the greatest joy for the participants in the class is the cultivation of compassion.
Yay! I like that. I like
and
that.
And it's not a fake kind of, oh, I'm being a good girl kind of thing. It's a genuine feeling of the rightness of being there with the juicy kind of richness of human experience. And I've felt it with the folks there. I've had what I consider to be the privilege to be part of the journey to death of three of the students I've worked with there. And they're some of the richest moments in the last few years. Yes, they hurt. And they were beautiful. And just that feeling of rightness, of following my heart. I don't know quite the words to describe it. But it's just juicy. It's rich. It feels like a source of well-being. And so I just want to add a voice that I'm not going around trying to be Saint Leslie. I'm really cultivating something that for me has just been an addition to the well-being.
And I would say, go ahead, be Saint Leslie. We need a few more Saint Leslies in this world.
I fail at that, but just the natural flow of being with those rich human experiences has just been amazing for me.
So I want to end this evening, or my portion of this evening, with a poem I read at the end of the meditation, because I love this poem. It might resonate even more for you now. It's called Dear Human, and for some of you, you might not have been here when I read it. It says, Dear Human, you've got it all wrong. You didn't come here to master unconditional love. That is where you came from and where you'll return. You came here to learn personal love, universal love, messy love, whole love, infused with divinity, lived through the grace of stumbling, demonstrated through the beauty of messing up often. You didn't come here to be perfect, you already are. You came here to be gorgeously human, flawed and fabulous, and then to rise again in remembering. But unconditional love, stop telling that story. Love in truth doesn't need any other adjectives. It doesn't require modifiers. It doesn't require the condition of perfection. It only asks that you show up and do your best, that you stay present and feel fully, that you shine and fly and laugh and cry and hurt and heal and fall and get back up and play and work and live and die as you. It's enough. It's plenty. So I thank you all so very much for your kind attention this afternoon or this evening.
A reminder that some of the folks who are here have added to the richness of the evening by providing some beautiful snacks that are over here. There's also a flyer for a four-day retreat that Robert and a colleague will be doing right up here at Vajrapani for an intensive on cultivating compassion.
On Thursday, come, you're all welcome.
Yeah, our good old Vajrapani right up out of our own area. And, of course, we make all this possible here at our center and thank people like Robert through our own generosity. So if you're not familiar with our way of doing that, we have two baskets outside. One is to help support our center, and one is specifically to thank Robert for his gifts this evening. Although bringing brownies and lovely fruits are pretty good, thank you, too, Robert. So I just want to encourage folks to stay for a while, enjoy some more visiting and some opportunity to talk more informally with Robert and to eat those yummy goodies. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you took questions and stuff, it's great if you can put them back.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.